Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Okay. So we're on Canto 5, Chapter 4, The Characteristics of Rishabhdev. And it's text number 4, which is a very long Sanskrit. It's not in rhyme, so I'm going to skip reading the Sanskrit. We'll do the word for word, and then we'll do the English translation and the purport. Nabihi, King Nabi, to certainly, yata abilasitam, according to his desire. Suprajastvam, the most beautiful son. Avarudya, getting. Ati Pramoda, of great jubilation. Bhara, by an excess. Vivalaha, being overwhelmed. Gadgada Aksharaya, faltering in ecstasy. Gira, with a voice. Swaram, by his independent will. Grita, accepted. Naraloka Sadharmam, acting as if a human being. Bhagavantam, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Purana Purusham, the oldest amongst the living beings. Maya, by Yoga Maya. Vilasita, bewildered. Matihi, his mentality. Vatsa, my dear son. Tata, my darling. Iti, thus. Sa anuragam, with great affection. Upalalayan, raising. Param, transcendental. Nirvritim, bliss. Upagataha, achieved. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Due to getting a perfect son according to his desire, King Nabi was always overwhelmed with transcendental bliss and was very affectionate to his son. It was with ecstasy and a faltering voice that he addressed him, "My dear son, my darling." This mentality was brought about by Yoga Maya, whereby he accepted the Supreme Lord, the Supreme Father, as his own son. Out of his supreme goodwill, the Lord became his son and dealt with everyone as if he were an ordinary human being. Thus King Nabi began to raise his transcendental son with great affection, and he was overwhelmed with transcendental bliss, joy, and devotion. Purport. The word Maya is used in the sense of illusion. Considering the Supreme Personality of Godhead to be his own son, Maharaj Nabi was certainly an illusion, but this was transcendental illusion. This illusion is required. Otherwise, how can one accept the Supreme Father as his own son? The Supreme Lord appears as the son of one of his devotees, just as Lord Krishna appeared as the son of Yashoda and Nanda Maharaj. These devotees could never think of their son as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, for such appreciation would hamper their relationship of paternal love. Okay. Okay, so a little bit of a change in attitude due to the influence of Yogamaya for King Nabi and Meru Devi. We assume the same feelings of affection and transcendental exchange as thinking themselves to be the parents of the Supreme Lord. The Supreme Lord, of course, is the cause of all causes, and everybody or everything comes from him. So then how does one consider that the Supreme Lord is dependent upon oneself? So that is all due to Maya. First of all, there was a tinge of Mahamaya, because we read that when King Nabi did the sacrifices or caused the sacrifices to be performed by which he could get a son, then he had a desire that he wanted to have a son. And that was a material desire. However, because he was a very elevated devotee, nevertheless, he requested that he could have a son like the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He wanted a son who was exactly like the Supreme Lord. So he had employed the Brahmanas to do the sacrifice by which that desire could be fulfilled. So the Brahmanas, also being great devotees, they were powerful enough that they could actually call the Supreme Lord down into their presence in the sacrifice. So they're also not ordinary Brahmanas. These are very great elevated Vaishnav saints. And because King Nabi went through them to himself, then the Supreme Lord agreed to appear in the sacrifice. Had King Nabi done it on his own, maybe he would not have come. But because he was called by other great sages who were acting as the guru of King Nabi, then the Supreme Lord agreed to appear there. And the Brahmanas, when he came, they were embarrassed that actually we've called you here to fulfill a material desire of our student or our follower, the King Nabi. Nevertheless, the Lord was very pleased because they only wanted to fulfill that desire through him. They wanted to have a son just like him with all the same qualities. And so he rewarded them by appearing as their son, Rishabhdev. Now we read that as he's growing up, he's first of all, he appears, he's a small baby, then he becomes a toddler, then he becomes a little boy, then gradually becomes a youth. So in the exchange of bringing him up as their son, that desire was superseded by the love that they developed for Rishabhdev. So whatever little tinge of material desire that the king and his wife had, that was completely finished as they dealt with the Supreme Lord as their son. They were feeling this transcendental affection. They forgot that he was the Supreme Lord. They could never have expressed this idea of my darling, my dear son, if they were still in the mood that this is the Supreme Lord. It would have hampered the exchange of feeling. So whatever material tinge that was there caused by Mahamaya was superseded by the transcendental feelings of affection that Yogamaya caused in them so that they could bring the Supreme Lord up as their son. And therefore we see that after some time, when the king retired from his kingdom and handed it over to Rishabhdev, then he was very happy to go off, I think, to Badarikeshram, one of those places, where he went into meditation. He performed all kinds of austerities, but those austerities were not difficult for him because he knew that he wasn't giving anything up. He had within his heart the Supreme Lord and his transcendental affection for him as his father. So those feelings of paternal affection were the sustenance of his vairagya. He was able to give everything else up because he actually developed this, or he got this shelter in his relationship with the Supreme Lord, and he was so absorbed in that that everything else became insignificant. So it was not difficult for him to perform that kind of sacrifice, giving up his kingdom, giving up his position and his wealth and everything else, and going like a mendicant up into the Himalayas. If you're living in the Himalayas, it's not easy. Yeah, it's not like, you know, everything is available. It's a place for austerities and penances. But King Nabi was able to perform those very, very joyfully because he had this higher taste. So that's the point. So in also, there's another comparable situation with Sutapa and Prishni. They were progenitors directly empowered by Lord Brahma to populate the universe. But they also, that's also not a very small position, to be the son of Lord Brahma, to populate the entire universe. You have to be extraordinarily empowered. So Sutapa and Prishni were in that category. They're not ordinary living beings. Very, very elevated personalities. But they also, they had a desire. They also wanted the Supreme Lord as their son. Now, they didn't want a son like the Supreme Lord. They wanted the actual Supreme Lord. So in order to get him, Prabhupada explains, they had to become sadhana siddhis, perfect in the practice of devotional life, in austerities and penances. Similarly with King Nabi, he's also performing jagya. That was the authorized process for that particular age. That's a sadhana. So he also became a sadhana siddhi by his performance of jagya. And similarly, Sutapa and Prishni, they had to perform great austerities and penances for 12,000 celestial years in order to get to the point where the Supreme Lord agreed to become their son. So in that way, then, there was some sadhana that was required. And when they became perfect in that, then the Supreme Lord appeared before them and told them, "Now I will come as your son three times." So the first time he came as Prishni Garbha. Prishni Garbha means from the womb of Prishni. And then the second time they took birth again as Aditi and Kasyapa, and they had the Supreme Lord as Vamanadev appear as their child. And then the third time, rather than get a plenary portion of the Lord, they got the Supreme Lord himself. But still, even then, their enjoyment of the Lord as their son was somewhat hampered. Yeah, even though it was Krishna himself, when he first appears to Devaki and Vasudeva in the jail, he takes on a four-arm form. And Prabhupada explains the reason he did that was just to remind them that in your previous lives you wanted me, the Supreme Lord, as your son, so here I am. If he had appeared in his two-arm form, they might have not been convinced that this was the Supreme Lord. So first of all, he displayed his opulent form for Narayan. Then he changed into two-armed baby Krishna and was immediately taken away. By the circumstances, he could not stay there, and they could not enjoy the transcendental babyhood of Lord Krishna and his toddler and his, you know, becoming a youth. That was denied them. So although Prabhupada in his purport here, he mentions Nanda and Jasoda as well as being the parents of the Supreme Lord, their category is a little bit different, and Prabhupada explains that they're actually Nitya Siddhas, whereas Devaki and Vasudev were Sadhana Siddhas because they had to do that penance and austerity to get the Supreme Lord to agree to appear as their child and have those feelings of paternal affection for him. But Nanda and Jasoda had no such requirement. They're actually expansions of the Supreme Lord. They're manifestations of his internal pleasure potency. And they're not ordinary living beings. They're not jivatmas. But they're actually, as Prabhupada says, nitya siddhas. So there was no requirement for them to do anything no jagya, no austerities and penances. They're just simply naturally Krishna's mother and father. And that position cannot be occupied by anybody else. Others can get the mood of paternal affection, and they can get elevated to the transcendental realm of Vrindavan and have that feeling of paternal affection, Vatsalya Ras, but they can never be Nandara and Jasoda. That's an exclusive category all of their own. So when Krishna appeared as the son of Vasudeva and Devaki, he immediately left them and he went to his preferred parents, Nandara and Jasoda. Not that he has any special preferences in one sense. Krishna says that he's always equal to every living being. But at the same time, there are gradations and varieties of the rasas. So there are the five main rasas, there's the seven sub-rasas, if you like. And then the mixtures of those cause all kinds of different gradations by which the living beings can reciprocate with the Supreme Lord and worship him and appreciate him in all different kinds of moods of affection. So this is known to the devotees. Mama Srita means that one who has taken shelter in Krishna. Therefore, in the Bhagavad Gita, you'll see that Bita means being purified. Being purified of what? Raga, Baya, Krodha. Krishna says it, that when you get freed from attachment, when you get freed from anger, when you get freed from frustration, then when you take shelter in me, then you attain this perfection of being in transcendental lila or rasa with him. As long as there's some other feeling there, material feeling, caused by contact with the material nature, those transcendental rasas cannot be fully manifest. So Krishna says that those who have been purified of all these different things, Bita, Raga, Baya, Krodha. Raga means attachment, so Sutapa and it's gone out of my head. Prishni, they had an attachment for sex. Prabhupada explains that. They had an attachment, they wanted to have sex, they were householders, but they only wanted to have sex to have a son who was the Supreme Lord. So it was a kind of dovetailed material desire. And in a similar way, Nabi and his wife Maradevi, they had an attachment for wanting to have a son, but they only wanted to have a son who was like the Supreme Lord. So although they were great devotees, there was this little tinge of raga or attachment, material attachment, and they had to become fully purified from that in order to be qualified to fully enter into the pastime. So we see that at the end of Nabi's life, he and his wife go back home, back to Godhead. But Nandara and Jasoda, they don't go back home, back to Godhead, because they are back home, back to Godhead. That's their position. So it's a little different. So one has to take full shelter in the Supreme Lord. And if we do so, then there's a question of transcendental pleasure and enjoyment, which is the real goal in life. Those who have material attachment can never understand the pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They can never understand how the Supreme Lord, who is the cause of all causes, who manifest this whole material universe and many, many others, how that supreme cause of all causes can appear just like an ordinary person and can be loved and can deal with his devotees in various different kinds of transcendental affection and exchanges. It's very bewildering to them. They can't even understand practically that God exists. The more one is attached to material nature, then the less one can understand anything about the Supreme Lord. Just recently, I had a visit in England to one of my old childhood friends. So he had been married for 38 years, which is quite a long time in this day and age. And then last year, his wife suddenly got diagnosed with cancer, and within a couple of months, she was gone. Finished. Then he burnt the body, you know, and put the ashes in some river in France that she liked to go and visit. So that was because of his attachment, she had expressed that desire. I had written to him when he first told me that she had died, and I thought, now what can I do which will help to benefit this soul? So I thought, I'll offer to put the ashes in the Ganges. And I gave some quote from Shastra, the benefit of having your ashes put in the Ganges. That way, even if the person's a materialist, doesn't know anything about Krishna consciousness, still there's tremendous benefit. And I thought, what's the use of being this man's friend since we were 5 years old if I can't do something, you know, to help improve himself spiritually? So I made the offer, but he never replied. So then I went to see him in June. And by the time I got there, already he had picked up another woman, some woman that he knew from 20, 30 years ago. And he was telling me how after his wife died, he was in so much distress. He lost, you know, like 30 pounds in weight. He became completely depressed to the point where he was feeling suicidal, because that was his whole life, his relationship with his wife, and now she was gone. So then he met this other woman, and somehow or another they hit it off, so now they're a couple. Now he's feeling okay again. So he was telling me, you know, the woman was there also. He was telling me how grateful he was she had saved him from the depths of depression and suicide. And I was sitting there thinking, well, okay, but what happens when she dies? Then you have to go through the same thing all over again. But I didn't tell him that because he's not ready to accept that or even to hear it. The point is that because of his great material attachment, he cannot understand anything about Krishna consciousness. He was with me when I joined the movement in 1972. We had emigrated from England to Australia. We met the devotees in the street the first day that we arrived. I was attracted. He couldn't care less. I had about a year, or less than that, 6 months, where I went through this kind of transformation or transition from being a complete, you know, mudha, materially, you know, bewildered soul, into waking up. And I was reading a Back to Godhead, and, you know, that was giving me food for speculation. And gradually I got to a point where I decided I have to leave everything and go find the devotees. And after meeting the devotees, then after a few weeks, I joined the temple and just left everything behind, including him, who was my childhood, you know, friend. We'd gone all the way through the three different levels of school together. We used to play together, everything. But he saw what I was going through, and I explained to him, you know, everything that I was thinking. Sometimes we would be up for hours on end, and I would just be, you know, blah, 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 blah. Whatever was coming in my brain, I had to get it out so that I could get new stuff coming in. And he would listen, but none of it made any impression on him, unfortunately. And so here we are, 42 years later. And he's still, because of his great material attachment, suffering like anything in this material world. And every time I go to England, which is almost every year, I go and I, you know, visit my mum, and I go and visit him. But we can't talk. It's all superficial, you know. You know, this is my grandson, this is my daughter, this is blah, blah, blah. Nothing spiritual. But I keep the friendliness up because I think that if at least he thinks well of somebody who's at least trying to be a devotee, then that will help him. And that, you know, every time I go, I take him some prasadam. He likes chuddy noodles and the Bombay mix and all that stuff that they make at the manor. So I take him some of that. So he gets some benefit from it. But I saw this time very clearly that even though his wife had died, and it was a great shock to the point where he was so depressed he was thinking about suicide, he never once asked, you know, if there was anything else to what life is and why we're here and why do we have to die and what happens when you leave the body, etc., etc. He's just not there. So this is, you know, this is raga, this is attachment. attachment to Mahamaya completely covers over the self. You identify only with the body. You identify only with this material world. Even something is given to you to try to convince you, otherwise you cannot understand it. So this is a great stumbling block in our lives as human beings. And what will happen, you know, when he leaves his body, who knows? Depending on his material attachments, to be carried away somewhere else. So this is the material world. Everybody's in that situation. It's very difficult to deal with. But if somehow or another, and another thought that I had was that, okay, here's this soul. He's suffering like anything. He's setting himself up again to go through the same amount of suffering again. And how many times has he been through this suffering in previous lives? And how many more times will he go through this suffering in the future? He's completely anchored in the material world. He's completely covered over by Mahamaya. So his future is just simply suffering. So such a person, maybe after a long time, they may actually start to get a little bit intelligent and think, why am I suffering? Why am I going through this again and again and again? And so they may get up to the point where they become very fearful of that material situation. They don't want it anymore. They don't want to suffer anymore. And so they become fearful of it, and that leads them to a degree of detachment. And when there's a degree of detachment, then there's a question of jnana. As long as that attachment is there, there's no question of knowledge. When you become a little detached from material life, then there may be a question that some real jnana or knowledge can come in, because you become a little bit receptive that I've tried this again and again, it's horrible, it's simply giving me suffering. Where can I find something else? What's the alternative? Why am I here? This is the process of going through the material world. So at that point, then one may become, you know, bitaraga baya, a little fearful of material existence. And hopefully one may then seek out some real knowledge, find out what's really, really happening and why we're suffering in the material world. Hopefully. But if that doesn't work, then what happens is that such a person may simply reject everything. Yeah, this is all, you know, illusion. It's temporary. It doesn't really exist. So he may reject it, become a renunciate. But then, without an alternative, the position remains the same. You may have attachment for material life, or you may have detachment from material life. But if you don't know what you really are as a soul, if you don't really know how this world is manifest, if you don't know what's beyond it, if you don't know that there's an alternative spiritual life, transcendental life, then you're still in the same position. You either raga or baya. You're accepting or you're rejecting. You're becoming fearful. But your suffering remains the same. So those who become detached from the material world without any transcendental understanding or understanding of transcendental relationship, because all of this is based on relationship. The materially attached person, where is his suffering mostly coming from? His relationship with another living being who's also in the bodily concept of life. He's attached to his own body, and then he's attached to the bodies of others, which he identifies as their selves. He identifies his body as his self. This attachment is guaranteed to cause him suffering and pain. Now, if he gives that up, if he becomes fearful of having another relationship, because it's going to lead him down the same path of depression and anxiety, you know, maybe committing suicide, you know, fearfulness, then if he doesn't replace his sense of relationship with a factual relationship, then where does he stand? In the same boat. You may give up your false material relationships. Oh, if I go with this woman now, what's going to happen in 5 years or 10 years? She's going to die or I'm going to die. And then again, the same business is going on. So if you don't have a realization that the point is that you need a relationship that lasts, then you're in the same boat of suffering. You'll never get out of it. You can either accept it or reject it, material relationships, but either way, you're not going to get any satisfaction whatsoever. Initially, you may get a little bit of relief by rejecting a material relationship, but the fact is that the living being is in essence related to other living beings. Everybody's related to everybody else because everybody's a manifestation of the supreme living being. So we're all from the same source. So we're all we're all related to each other. You cannot escape relationships. And we're related in a spiritual way. The Supreme Lord is eternally the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He eternally has relationships with every living being that emanates from Him. And every living being is also eternal and has an eternal relationship with Him and with other living beings. So relationship is the essence of happiness. We instinctively look for happiness in relationships. Now, if a person becomes disgusted with his material relationships, but doesn't replace that or rediscover his spiritual relationships, which are true, then where does he stand? Still, he has no happiness. You don't get happiness from a false relationship, and you don't get happiness from rejecting relationships either. So the idea of becoming free from material relationship and entering into some kind of, you know, spiritual oblivion. Even if you come to the point you know you're not this body, but if you don't know that you are an eternal relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then you still don't become happy. You may get some relief, apparently, but even if you get to the point you can get out of this material world, you don't go to the spiritual world where these transcendental relationships are the key feature. So you're in a kind of limbo land and it's spiritual suicide. You don't want to commit material suicide, but you commit spiritual suicide because you're rejecting relationship. First of all, you're in a wrong relationship, which is guaranteed to make you suffer, and then you want to have no relationship, which is also guaranteed to make you suffer. So in that way then, bita raga baya krodha, then you become angry. Then you become frustrated. Yeah? Because either way, there's no happiness, and happiness is what we're looking for. So if we really want to get happiness and satisfaction, we need gyan. We need to get some authorized knowledge from persons who have matured in their spiritual realization and who have come to the point of understanding that they have this transcendental relationship with the Supreme Lord. And those persons who can direct us to that platform, they are the real gurus. They have real knowledge. And they can actually give us real happiness. So this is the business of the devotees, that they canvass amongst those who are in ignorance, either, you know, the materially attached or the materially detached, and they try to convince them about the real nature of spiritual life, that it's full of this transcendental happiness. It's full of transcendental rasa and relationship. And then they try to help the fallen souls to enter into that right relationship. So Maharaj Nabi, although he had some kind of a material attachment, it wasn't very much. He knew about the Supreme Lord. He knew about having a relationship with the Supreme Lord. Just some tinge was there that he had a desire for a son. But he dovetailed that very nicely. Lord Rishabhdev appeared and obliged him because he went through the right channels, the transcendental brahmanas who did the sacrifice. And in that way, then he awarded his childhood pastimes to a certain degree to Maharaj Nabi. Now, not to the full degree, just like Devaki and Vasudev. So, in a similar way, King Nabi and Maradevi, they had the sun, they were feeling these transcendental happiness from having him as their son. But at the same time, at a certain point, they handed him over to the Brahmanas to be trained up as a king. So there's a consideration there about becoming a king, the formality of that. He had to be trained how to deal with all the different kinds of citizens, how to execute the duties of a king, keep the treasury, keep your army. You know, there's a formal relationship between the king and the subjects that always has to be maintained. So in that way, then, there's some restriction on the pleasure that Maharaj Nabi was having with Rishabdev. It's not this, by comparison, it's not the same as the unrestricted transcendental happiness that Nanda and Yasoda were enjoying. And even Prabhupada says even Nanda Maharaj was not having the same kind of transcendental happiness, or the depth of it, that Yasoda was. Because Yasoda was always with Krishna. But sometimes Nanda Maharaj wasn't. Because anyway, that's technicalities. But the point is that Rishabdev was brought up as a king. And he had to be trained that way by his parents. So even though they were forgetful sometimes of the fact that the Supreme Lord is my son, because the parental rasa would overcome that, you know, idea that he's the Supreme Lord, at the same time, they didn't get the same depth of transcendental reciprocation that Nanda and Yasoda had. So there's different degrees of parental affection, just like when you look at the friends of the Supreme Lord, there's different types of friends. There's some friends that he regards as equal. There's some friends that he regards as his own superior. There's some friends that he regards as being juniors. And there's different ways that they relate to each other according to their status. So Rishabdev, as the son of King Nabi, was certainly awarding his childhood pastimes to him, but there was some restriction. There was some, you know, other influence there, because he had come for a particular purpose and a particular mission. That mission, of course, was to spread Krishna consciousness, to give an understanding of transcendental relationship to all the conditioned souls that were in his kingdom. And Maharaj Nabi also had that desire. That was one of his purposes in having the Supreme Lord as his son. He was a king. It was his duty to bring up his citizens, or have his citizens raised up to the platform of transcendental relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So he also had some kind of a, you know, guiding principle there. He was a king, his son had to be a king. The idea was the same, to give Krishna consciousness to all the fallen souls, as many as possible. But that kind of inhibits, you know, the depth of relationship that they can have. But with Nanda and Yasoda, it was totally uninhibited. That is, you know, Vatsalya Rasa, parental affection in its fully manifest form. Okay, so we have to finish at 8:45. I'll finish there. Gyanagami Prabhu. Use the microphone.
We see that Kartama Muni also leaves his son, Piladev.
Now I can't hear you.
I say we see that Kartama Muni also leaves his son, Kapiladev, incarnation of Krishna, when very shortly after he's born. But my question is, why, if Krishna's your son, even if you can't experience the highest rasa like Mother Yasoda, but if he's your son, why would you leave to go off and perform austerities and penances? I don't understand.
Why would King Nabi leave to perform austerities?
Yeah, why would Kartama Muni also leave?
It's a good question, and the answer is that at least at that time, when Nabi was living, that was the recommended process. So as a king, he had to show the way. Yeah, so going off to the Himalayas, performing austerities and penances, becoming detached. For him, it wasn't a problem because he, you know, within his heart, he was always meditating on his relationship with the Supreme Lord. But he had to still show the example for the rest of the citizens. Had he not gone, then they would have used that as an excuse that, well, the king didn't perform austerities and penances at the end of his life, why should I? So according to that, you know, time frame, he had to show that example.
Thank you, Jai.
Gita Nagari Prabhu.
You're explaining that Yashoda and Nanda Maharaj are the natural, eternal parents of Krishna, and therefore they didn't have to undergo any austerity. But we know that Yashoda and Nanda Maharaj were Drona and Dara in their last life, and they got some kind of blessing from Lord Brahma. Can you explain that? And
yes. They were Drona and Dara. So they made their appearance in the material world ahead of the Supreme Lord. They were actually sent by Krishna. And whenever Krishna appears, he has to set the scene for his own appearance. So his devotees come ahead of him. And then, you know, they assume various situations and roles. And then he comes within that. But as Drona and Dara, when they prayed to Lord Brahma, because that's kind of like the authorized agency, they didn't have to do any penance as Sutapa and Prishni did. Sutapa and Prishna also wanted the same thing, but they had to then, after praying for that, they had to go and perform 12,000 years of austerities and penances. Drona and Dara didn't have to do that. They just immediately appeared as Nanda and Yashoda and waited for Krishna to come. So, you know, between that they recognized Lord Brahma, you know, as the supreme living being in the universe. So out of politeness and etiquette, you know, they went to him and took his permission. But beyond that, they didn't have to do anything. Actually, they didn't even really have to take his permission, but it was an etiquette that they observed. But there was no question of them then having to, you know, do some sacrifices or austerities and penances. They just immediately appeared as Nanda and Yashoda, and then they waited for, you know, Krishna Stu Bhagavan Swayam, not a plenary portion of the Lord, you know, or other manifestation of him, but the Supreme Lord in his original feature then came and, you know, appeared in their family. When Yashoda woke up, she didn't even know who she'd had, you know, when she had gave birth. She couldn't remember whether she'd had a boy or a girl. So that's transcendental bewilderment. Whereas Devaki, when the Supreme Lord appeared from her, first of all, he showed himself as Four-Armed Narayan, just to remind them, yeah, that I am the Supreme Lord. And then he told them that you should now, because you're not going to enjoy my childhood pastimes, you should now meditate upon me as the Supreme Lord for the next 12 years. That never happened with Yashoda. Yashoda didn't even know she'd had a boy or a girl. She was just transcendentally bewildered from beginning to end by Krishna. And therefore, you know, when the different pastimes unfolded, like Krishna opening his mouth so that she could see whether he'd eaten some dirt or not, he was a liar, Balaram was a liar, they were all lying. But there's no fault in that, because it was all to enhance the transcendental exchanges that they were having with Mother Yashoda. And when she looked in Krishna's mouth and saw the entire material ingredients and the causes for their agitation, I mean, everything was there in Krishna's mouth, she became completely stunned, and she couldn't figure out, is this something wrong with me? Has my brain, you know, suddenly gone haywire? Or is this something that Krishna's doing? Or is this something the demigods are doing? She just couldn't figure it out. So at a certain point, she just, you know, clicked out of it and went back to cuddling Krishna. You know, none of this Supreme Lord stuff. That was not a consideration at all. But we see in these other pastimes, this, you know, there's a recognition there at some point of Krishna as the Supreme Lord. Even they move into, you know, the parental affection afterwards. But there's still that, you know, I mean, with King Nabi, He did his yajnas through the brahmanas, and then the Lord appeared before them all at the sacrificial fire and told him, I'm coming now as your son. So he knew that that his son was the Supreme Lord. But Yogamaya kind of, in order to enhance the parental pastimes of bringing him up, you know, made him forget that. But there was a point where he knew that. And similarly with Devaki and Vasudeva, they knew that Krishna was the Supreme Lord. They were shown that right at the very beginning when he appeared. Later on, they could forget it. But Yashoda, that was never a question, that Krishna is the Supreme Lord. And even if it appeared that he was something like the Supreme Lord, or some extra special being, that, get out the way. Throw that thought out. Yeah, just cuddle Krishna, feed him your breast milk, you know, chastise him, make sure that he's not in any danger. This is, you know, it's a different level of affection. It's the same rasa, but, you know, different feature. Okay, we'll finish there. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Dave's instructions to his sons, because that's relevant.